Welcome to Still Processing. Still Processing is an educational nonprofit that we started 3 years ago. And we have met every month since then. It was November. I looked it up. It was November 3, 2022 when we had our first one. And I think we would have felt quite good if you would have told us that in 3 years we'd be here, still going, having raised money in order to keep it going, continuing to raise money so that we can do more next year, including taking me on as an employee. I would have been thrilled and grateful, and so I am thrilled and grateful. Thank you to everybody here who has come over the last 3 years. If it's your first time here, I'm grateful that you're finding it now. Thank you. I just simply say that Still Processing is an educational nonprofit because that's what we've been for 3 years, is we've been a place where we try to have important, difficult, controversial conversations. We try to bring people together who are in a similar place. Sometimes that means in a similar place theologically or with religion. A lot of times for me that has meant moving away from religion, and that's true of other people here, or staying in religion but feeling kind of uncomfortable, like I don't know if I fit here anymore. This is a place for you if you're still in it, right, and going and enjoying it, great. And also enjoying this, totally fine. I'm not trying to take you away from anything that's working for you. You know what I mean? Things are hard enough. I'm not going to take away things that are working for people. So wherever you are on religion or politics, you are welcome here. I will just admit out front, and people who've been here know this, this is quite a progressive space. So if you are quite conservative, this will feel less comfortable to you, admittedly. I just want to say that out front. My name is Joshua Viss. I'm one of the co-founders, along with my father, Marlon. And I've been doing the hosting duties and will continue to do them. And I want to then shift. I don't think there's anything else. Am I missing anything else I should be saying about Still Processing? Dad says no. Excellent. I want to shift then to tonight and why we're here tonight, which is to have a conversation with Mark Braverman about Israel, about Palestine, about us, about the United States. This is meant to be a pretty broad conversation about what's happening in Israel, Palestine specifically, but what does that mean for the world, right? What does it mean for us? So Mark Braverman was born into a conservative Zionist Jewish family in Philadelphia in 1948, not to give your birth date away. Too late, sorry. Same year as my father, which is interesting to me. You were trained as a psychologist, right? That's your educational background. And though he was... If you want to correct, use the mic.
That was my professional training when I grew up, or I thought I was growing up, but my educational background... is Jewish Zionist, really. That was what was foundational.
Yeah,
it just occurred to me.
Usually
you don't put that in your resume.
Would you say what Zionist, just define that term in your own words for folks? I think it's important that we do that at the outset.
Well, we're going to get right into it. Okay. Well, Zionism...
But make it quick, because I'm not done with your intro. Thank you.
Well... Can't ask me a question like that and ask me to make it quick.
I have been told that you making it quick is unlikely.
Exactly. why don't we save that, Josh, because we're going to jump into that pretty early on.
Okay, great. I just want to make sure we don't miss that. One of the difficulties that we might have tonight is, like, we've been in this. He's been in since 2000, well, his whole life in a sense, but there was a shift in 2006 that happened with you when he went to the West Bank, right? So that's one of the two Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza, and saw what was happening there, and since then have become a champion for Palestinian human rights. And I say that the reason I say that is to introduce him, but to also say that sometimes when you've been in a certain discipline a long time, you end up saying things and thinking everybody knows what you're talking about. And I just want to be cognizant of that. So when we get to it, we'll explain what Mark, how he understands Zionism. Author of two books, A Wall in Jerusalem, Hope, Healing, and the Struggle for Justice in Israel and Palestine, and Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. You are, if I'm getting this right, currently the executive director of Kairos USA, still in that role. And
I can't find a successor.
Okay. And co-founder of Friends of Tent of Nations North America. Tent of Nations, some of you will know, that's Daoud Nasser's farm in the West Bank near Bethlehem. Is there anything else you want to add to the background there? That's all I have for you.
No, that's fine. I'll
okay. Okay, I'm going to start us with a video. And before I start this video, this is, and listen, this is a positive video. I want you to know that I'm working hard to put hopeful, positive things in when I think it works. And this is one of those things. So I want you to read what it says there. I'll read it. Me and my Arab parents, on the way to make history and vote for the first ever Muslim on the ballot for mayor of New York City. So this is just a little mix of things from that victory on Tuesday.
Mama, how do you feel going to vote today? Are you crying?
Yes, I need my daddy.
Yes!
We all want to buy.
Mamdani.
This one, yes?
Mamdani.
You put a heart by Mamdani's name?
Yeah,
wait,
little.
You
put
oh.
Three hearts by Mamdani's name?
The name is Mamdani.
I wish Andrew Cuomo only the best in private life. But let tonight be the final time I utter his name. So, Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up. New York will remain a city of immigrants, a city built by immigrants, powered by immigrants. And as of tonight, led by an immigrant. So hear me, President Trump, when I say this. To get to any of us, you will have to get through all of us.
So I use that partially because it's hopeful. Right? Tuesday was a boost for me. I'll just admit that. I realized these were pretty easy wins, but I'm still psyched about it. But not just because of that. Partially what Mark and I want to say and will say is that we're starting to see what's happening as a global struggle. This is not just an Israel-Palestine thing or a United States thing, right? Or a Europe thing or a China thing. This is a global struggle. And I think Mamdani's win is symbolic and important, not just for the, I mean, think about being a Muslim in New York City. Think if you've been there since 9/11. I mean, can you imagine having been a Muslim in New York after 9/11? There's the little in and out. And then getting to this point, it's unbelievable, right? It's beautiful. It's why I'm so, so happy for them, which is why I wanted to show a couple of people. You see here at the end, you know, the young woman here has the Palestinian keffiyeh on, right? So there's a direct connection. Mark, what do you think? What does the Mamdani thing mean to you?
Wow. I got that was really enough for me watching that. You know, it was a good night in general. There were other races which showed that there is a real shift. And that's really good news. Yeah. Actually, I haven't used the word hope for a while. And we need to keep, we need reasons to hope. Yeah. I will tell you the thing, frankly, because I was expecting Mamdani to win. The thing that gets me most excited about the election results from last night, besides New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, is California. Maybe the Democratic Party is finally figuring out that if they are going to win and have any power, they're going to have to get down in the dirt and play just as dirty as the Republicans have been playing for decades. Yeah. And the Democrats are saying, well, we're going to play by the rules. You know, this is a democracy, which is like so clueless about how things work in this plutocracy that we live in. They're finally saying, okay,
it's bless your heart. That, I think, is the term you would use towards a Democrat who thinks we can play by the rules and win.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Bless
good
your
luck.
Heart.
Good luck
that's
with
the
that.
South,
how's
I think.
Work,
that's how's
for, yeah, it's yeah. The South. How's it working for you? Right? So it's a little late, but they're finally figuring out that to play by the rules is to basically game the system and work the system. I mean, I heard an interview with some guy in California, who said, you know, I would have never voted for something like this in the past because it's illegal and it's not democratic and it's dirty and it's gaming the system. It's not supposed to work that way. You're not supposed to mess around with districts so that you can get votes. Right. That's bad. He says, now I'm voting for that. Mm-hmm. It's getting real.
So I want to turn us now to Israel-Palestine, which is what we're here for. I want to show you this clip. It's about 3 minutes long, a little bit longer than I usually like to do. But I think it's important, and I think it will give you something to react to that will probably feel very relevant, more so to you probably than to me, but I feel some of this too. This is Gideon Levy and also Peter Beinart, who we'll talk about a little bit later. So Gideon Levy is on your left, and Peter Beinart on your right. Gideon Levy is a really, really famous decades-long writer for Haaretz. So if you ever read Israeli news, there's really three, I don't know, I guess I would say three major outlets, but kind of just two, the Jerusalem Post, more right-leaning, and Haaretz, more left-leaning. And he has written and for them for decades, and he has been a stalwart advocate for Palestinian human rights. And then at the back half of this video, you're going to hear from a woman named Orly Noy, who is an Iranian Jewish woman. Both of these people live in Jerusalem. Both fight for Palestinian human rights. Orly Noy works for Plus 972 and Local Call. These are smaller independent news agencies. Plus 972 has been incredible during the war in terms of the reporting they've done. Like we learned about Israel using AI to find bombing targets from Plus 972. We learned that internal Israeli documents say that 83% of those kills are civilians because of the reporting of Plus 972. And I just want you to hear from them what it's been like to be that type of person in Israel since October 7th.
Has there been a change, though, over the years, and particularly since October 7th? Do you feel a shift in the culture as it is expressed to you and the towards dissidents in general?
Major change. I lost most of my friends, not on a personal basis. I didn't lose any friend, but they all changed. They all changed.
How?
Unbelievable. And the 7th of October, after the 7th of October, they don't interest us anymore, the Palestinians. They must be punished. Hamas must be terminated. All Gaza is Hamas. I mean, you wouldn't believe some of really my best colleagues and friends who were with me all around. I'll tell you more than this. My wife, my partner, she's a Swedish writer. We met in Gaza 18 years ago. She was an activist. She studied Arabic in Beer Zeit when she was 17, yeah? And even she now sees the whole thing in different eyes, unfortunately. I'm much more lonely than ever, really. Almost nobody to talk with. People change their minds because of the 7th of October.
Because of the trauma, because of the trauma and the fear and the horror of October 7th.
And also to take revenge, to punish them.
Yes.
Right. I mean, they don't want to hear that. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. And for me, it's not political. It's a moral problem.
Yes.
Because I have no one to share my emotions.
In the past 2 years, it's not alienation. It's just fear. I mean, I'm terrified by this society. I stand in the balcony and I smoke and I look at the people and I say every one of them is supporting genocide. Every one of them is either participating, you know, were in the military in those 2 years, or their sons or their brothers or their, you know, it's my neighbor from the apartment downstairs, and it's the grocery store guy that is sitting there with the uniform. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. So and also it penetrates the most intimate circles. I cut ties with immediate family members because it was just, we couldn't handle this anymore. With friends, with close friends, it's a very lonely place to be at here right now.
Yeah, Mark, what's it been like for you? I mean, it's been difficult for you since 2006 in certain ways, coming out for Palestinian human rights after being a part of a Zionist family, probably friend group, all of those things. But what about since October 7th? Have there been additional challenges and difficulties, I imagine?
Well, I'm really struck by what Gidon says, that he lost friends. People who he thought were his friends, or people, well, they're still his friends, but people who he thought were on the same page as him. And all of a sudden, because of October 7th, some truth that was always there but had not surfaced is revealed. Mm-hmm. And the truth shows how isolated and unique and how much of a teeny infinitesimal minority is him and Amir Ahas, who's another Haaretz journalist who's wonderful, and Orlinoy. Yeah. It shows that their values have always been fundamental humanistic values. And it shows that all the people, at least that Levy is talking about, that was on the surface. And it didn't go deep enough, because underneath that surface is the fear and the exceptionalism and the racism that has been programmed into Israeli Jews from the cradle. You know, when I was growing up, and it's kind of a reduction or an essence of what I grew up with, which was the world, all of them out there, we called them Goyim, Gentiles. Or for me, it was the non-Jewish world. I mean, I grew up thinking that the world was basically Jewish, but out there is this non-Jewish world. And when I discovered fairly late in life, like late teenage years, that I was a minority, because I was so programmed to believe that I was at the center of the world, which means the Jewish people are at the center of the world. And we are smarter, better than anybody else, that the rest of the world is an ignorant, drunken rabble that wants to kill me. Now, that was my grandmother's reality in Europe. And it's as if it was injected right into my veins growing up in mid-20th century Philadelphia, where I never experienced myself any anti-Semitism because I was protected from it.
Well, some of it, I mean, we know from studies that some of it is passed down through genes, right? Some of the trauma, right?
Yeah.
Just to say that it wasn't, as far as I understand, it wasn't simply that you were being told these things. It was also a part of your being in some way.
It was transmitted, and maybe it is genetic. You know, you got 2,000 years of genes that were passed down to me. And you have 2,000 years, we can talk about it later, we have 2,000 years of collective trauma creating a post-trauma, an undiagnosed, untreated post-traumatic stress disorder collectively. That's Israel. And so all of Gideon Levy's friends, what comes up is the underlying psychology and sensibility, which is finally triggered by, I wanted to say 9/11. That's interesting. October 7th. I've heard this from other sources as well. All of a sudden, all of the, quote, left-wing Israelis, that the Israeli left is exposed as being just a patina over the fundamental illness of an unresolved post-traumatic stress reaction, which means that you have lost your ability to trust. That's the real injury of PTSD. And when it comes to it, you are going to turn into, you're either going to die inside and or you're going to turn all of that injury and all of that aggression outside. So it's no mystery to me that Israelis believe that all the Gazans are Hamas, which means they're all hateful and murderous and want to kill me and are not quite human and should be exterminated. It was not a surprise.
Okay. Yeah. So I want to turn a little bit. I want to give you a chance. I'm going to just go through a couple things and give you a chance to talk about the boomerang effect, which we talked about earlier today. Just so you know, this has been pretty quiet, but the U.S. State Department, the U.S. government knows full well that Israel has committed hundreds of human rights violations. You can see here, this is from the Washington Post, classified U.S. report finds backlog of hundreds of possible Israeli human rights violations. And this is backed up by UN reports, by New York, I mean, just all kinds of evidence that gross human rights violations were committed in Gaza by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. And also, just to be clear, by Hamas and other Palestinian militants on October 7th. But we are in a really, I don't even know how to describe it exactly, but I think Mark will have some words about it. So this is a woman that I just want you to know exists because she's an amazing woman. Her name is Francesca Albanese, and she's the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. And she's been doing amazing work for the UN, including, most recently in July, a report that's titled From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. She named companies including Lockheed Martin and Caterpillar, which have provided physical equipment for the destruction of Gaza, and Amazon, Alphabet is the parent company of Google. Microsoft, Palantir is sort of the new one. That's Peter Thiel, if that's a name you've heard. Palantir, they're working on a lot of surveillance technology. And what this report has done is it's gone beyond just what did the IDF do in Gaza to what are the other countries and corporations that are making this possible. For her work, she has been, in some way, the U.S. government here has announced that they're imposing sanctions on her. She became a specially designated national, a status generally reserved for arms and drug smugglers, terrorists, and oligarchs who have funded them. That's what our government has done to Francesca Albanese. And this is the Israeli UN representative talking about her, and then you'll get to see her chat a little bit.
Miss Albanese, you are a witch.
Yes, you heard that right. Danny Danon, Israeli representative at the UN, just called the special rapporteur for Palestine a witch. His choice wording is in response to a 24-page report Albanese delivered that identified 63 states in the collective crime of genocide in Gaza.
Weapons, intelligence and joint trainings have fed the genocidal machinery. Arms and surveillance devices that have been field-tested on the Palestinians. And despite 2 years of genocide, the European Union, quick to sanction Russia over Ukraine, remains Israel's main trade partner.
Safe to say, it hasn't gone down well with the Israeli representative.
Every time you try to curse Israel with falsehood and libels, your curses fail. You are a witch, and this report is another page in your spell book. You have tried to curse Israel with lies and hatred, but your poison has failed, because you are a failed witch. Your words have no power, and your report will have no impact.
The use of such language was flagged by the chair, who requested Danon to avoid using derogatory and personal remarks. Albanese herself gave this response.
Look, it's grotesque and frankly delusional that a genocidal state can't respond to the substance of my findings. And the best thing that he resorts to is accusing me of witchcraft. So it be it. You're the one accused of genocide. If the worst thing you can accuse me for is witchcraft, I take it. But rest assured that if I had the power to make spells, I would use it to stop your crimes once and for all, and to make sure that those responsibles end up behind bars. And I would make sure that everyone from the river to the sea, Jewish people, Muslim people, Christian people, and secular people lived in freedom and enjoying their rights, not just privilege for few, again, between the river and the sea.
She's awesome. She's awesome. and then before I ask you to respond about the boomerang effect, there's also another gentleman worth considering, if this is an issue that interests you, is Chris Hedges. He's a journalist. He wrote for the New York Times for a long time. He's now an independent journalist. He's also a Presbyterian, ordained in the PCUSA, I believe, right? Isn't that right? Yeah. And he is trying to note here in this Substack that what's happening in Gaza is a blueprint to some degree for what's going to happen around the world. So he says here, it does not mark the end, Gaza, of the settler colonial project. It marks, I fear, its final phase. And his concern is around the climate crisis and all of the refugees and problems that that is going to create. And his point is that the struggle for Palestine is our struggle. The denial of freedom for Palestinians is the first step in the loss of our freedom. The terror that defines life in Gaza will become our terror. The genocide will become our genocide. We must fight these battles while we still have a chance. Does that resonate with you, Mark?
You know, I follow him, and I encourage you all to follow him as well. And when I read this I think it was late last week, it blew my mind, because I had already taken a couple of paragraphs out of this and put it in, getting ready to write my own Substack. And I just said, Chris, I can't say it better than Chris Hedges, and I was going to be writing about the boomerang. So I taught a course this past summer called Zionism, the Church's Colonial Legacy and the Palestinian Call. And we started off by simply studying post-colonial writers as a foundation for understanding Israel and Palestine, understanding October 7th, understanding Zionism. You have to understand colonialism, and that is very broad. It goes way back, and it's basically Western civilization.
Essentially.
Yes. And with the church hand in hand, right, with the empire, whoever is in charge, giving theological legitimacy to literally a papal bull saying, from the 15th century, just before 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, right? There was a papal bull saying, God wants you to go out there and do all of this for God. Take the lands and exterminate the indigenous inhabitants or convert them or something, I don't know. So we're studying that, and we were studying post-colonial writers, and I discovered, thanks to Noor Erekat, which is another name you should know, a Palestinian-American attorney who teaches at Rutgers, and she wrote a piece in the Boston Review over the summer called Gaza, The Boomerang Comes Back. Now, the boomerang is taken from a Martinican black man, mid-century, who wrote about, well, here's what he said the boomerang is. He said the metropole, which if you parse the word means the mother country, metropole, polis, what it does to its colonial possessions and subjects, the racism, the dehumanization, the demonization, the theft, the extraction, the attempt to annihilate them in order to gain their land and to pillage and profit from their resources. That comes back like a boomerang to the mother country. It gives permission to do to your own people what you are doing to them. That's her critical lens, that's her analysis of Gaza.
And so I would just to note.
And what Chris says is, this is our struggle, this is our fight. We're doing this. Obviously, it's our war and it's our genocide. I wrote almost exactly the same words as Hedges did. This is our struggle, this is our genocide. I'll have more to say about that in terms of what we need to do about Gaza and what our responsibility is.
I was just going to say that when I think about the boomerang effect right now, I think of ICE.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What ICE is doing right now to the most vulnerable people in our population is the type of thing that Israel does, right? Mostly to Palestinians at this point. But if you happen to be on the left in Israel over the last 2 years and tried in some way to protest for Palestinian human rights, I've seen the videos. The police show up fast, and they put you on the ground, and they arrest you.
That's right.
Right? It was a police state.
Yeah.
Largely. If you were protesting for the hostages, you had a little bit more leeway, right?
Oh, sure.
But if you were protesting for Palestinians, forget it. So I would say these are examples of the boomerang effect already happening in our country and also, obviously, in Israel.
Well, and to go back to what Gideon Levy was saying,
mm-hmm.
I mean, those friends that he had lost, that's in the effect of the boomerang.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it has already infected the country. By its very nature, an ethnic nationalist project, settler colonial project, like Zionism, is going to have an effect, a fundamental effect, on who we are. So think about the fact that we are a settler colonial country. That's how we started. And it's in there. It's in our DNA. And it never goes away.
Yeah, the Ottawa and the Potawatomi, that's whose land we're on.
Exactly. Exactly. And the only thing the only way that it's possible to deal with that in any kind of human way or have any hope that that can be overcome in any way is to see it, is to recognize it, is to have your eyes opened. Which, by the way, if you want to talk about religion, that was a lot of what Jesus was saying when he gave his initial blessing. Free the captives, us. Open the eyes of the blind, us. Right?
Perfect. We're going to do religion right now, actually. But I have a little short video that I want to show you as an opening for this. So before I do that, though, I need you to know this verse. It may not be interesting to you, generally speaking, but it has played a role in what's happened in Gaza. So this is from 1 Samuel 15. Samuel said to Saul, so Saul's like the first, kind of the first king of Israel. The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish the Amalekites for what they did in opposing the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek. You're going to hear that a lot in the video. And utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. We're going to start by referencing that verse in what you're going to see. And then you're going to hear a montage of the Lord's Prayer being done by the, he heads the Department of Defense, but he calls it Department of War. And it was an official video put out by the Department of War that you're going to see.
So I want to just walk you through the video that focused on Israel, because it's in Hebrew with subtitles and that doesn't work over audio. So it's a variety of political and other public figures, soldiers, media figures, other people in government like Netanyahu and his finance minister. And it's basically them referencing Amalek from the Bible and applying it to Gaza and Palestinians. And the message is quite clear, both in the passage and in their repeating of it, their use of it, which is that it's a genocidal intent. Amalek is to be wiped off the map entirely. Its memory, everything about it, all the people, women, children, and it even includes the animals in the biblical reference. And this was referenced in Israel publicly many, many times. Second video that I'm going to let play is Pete Hegseth saying the Lord's Prayer with a ton of military imagery, right, on the B-roll playing behind the audio, all sorts of images of soldiers, aircraft carriers, fighter jets, etc.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen.
Yeah, the Department of War and the Defense Department put that out. That was in September. September 20 is when I first saw it.
That was put out by the Department of War?
Yeah, out by our Defense Department. That's correct. Yeah, Cook, go ahead. You're up.
So, you know, I thought I had a story that was shocking, and I use it a lot in my teaching. So I'm walking down one of the little alleyways and streets of the old city of Jerusalem. If you've ever been there, you know, you're led around corners, and it's very close, and you're surrounded by stone walls. And I'm in the Jewish quarter. And I turn a corner, and I end up looking face-to-face with a wall. And it's got a monument plaque, a commemoration plaque, right on the wall. At the top, there's a very crude rendition of the flag of the State of Israel. And underneath, in Hebrew, it says, "Here was murdered the Holy One, Elchanan somebody, on such and such a date." I think it was in like 1978. There was a Jewish yeshiva student, an American kid, who came to Israel, Orthodox Jew, to study Talmud and Torah in one of the yeshivas, in one of the it's like a Jewish madrasa, right? And he was attacked in the old city, and he was murdered. It was never solved, but the assumption, probably true, was that he was killed by some Palestinians. It was a violent crime. This is a section of the city that was being encroached upon by the state of Israel to make it not Jew, not Muslim anymore, but Jewish. So, and then it goes on. It says, by his blood we will live, and we will avenge his death. He was killed by the evil ones. And then it quotes from Deuteronomy. Who, what's his name, was quoting there from Israel. Quotes from Deuteronomy, it says, because of what they did to you, erase the memory of Amalek. And so...
And Amalek is not a people group that we've ever found in archaeology or history. It's just like a boogeyman of the people who terrorized Israel in Egypt, you know, like a long time. So it's used as this kind of just amorphous enemy, essentially, even in the Bible, really. It's
a symbol, it's a code word, it's a meme.
Yeah.
And I grew up with that. So on every year on Passover, when we have the Passover Seder, which commemorates the liberation from bondage, and then the wanderings through the desert, and then the conquest of Palestine, and the redemption of the promised land, of getting the promised land, cashing in on that promise. part of that Passover liturgy is, in every age, a tyrant rises up to annihilate us. That's the word that's used. And God saves us from their hands. In every age, there is an Amalek. It's part of a part of Jewish identity, and it's right there programmed in from the core. Now, I sound kind of anti-Semitic, don't I? Okay, I just want to say, I love my Jewish heritage. I love the liturgy. I love my Bible study. I was steeped in it. I can open up the Book of Psalms and read it in the original. It's an amazing gift. Even though I can't step into a synagogue, it's in me. But along with all of that, there's a dark side. I absorbed all of this poison. It's right there.
Why do you say I can't step in a synagogue?
Well, if I'm going to go to synagogue and I have to face the Ark of the Covenant where the Torah scrolls are, if any of you have ever been in a synagogue, you know, that's, instead of the cross, you've got the scrolls of the law, of the Torah.
And first five side, books of the Bible, Torah, for folks. Torah, first
it's
five,
Pentateuch.
Genesis,
it's the five,
Exodus,
five books of Moses, the first five books of the Bible. Actually, you have to add the sixth book, which is the book of Joshua. We don't talk about that much. On either side, in most American synagogues, you've got an American flag, and on the other side, you've got the flag of the state of Israel. That says it all. I couldn't worship there. And also, I had to get out. I couldn't be in that community anymore because I felt all of this all the time. I had to leave. But I haven't stopped being Jewish. Yeah. We'll talk more about that.
I like... There it is. It's back. Like when I like to joke that I'm named Joshua, right?
Yeah, right.
And I'm like, who'd their parents name you after? I was like, that's right. That's right. I know. But one was genocidal, and that one was definitely named Joshua. So I sometimes think, odd choice. So I want to use something from Peter Beinart. Is this getting funky on me? Let's see if this one works. Test. I know. Okay, we might have to do that. Now this one's like, listen. Now it's making noise. If I were still religious, I'd make a joke about God, but I'm not. So I want to play something. Let me see what time it is in terms of time. Actually, I'm going to skip this part. Is that all right if I do that to you? Do you want to say, I'm going to use this quote from the intro of your book, So this is actually not your writing. It's Brueggemann's writing. And he says, the central aim of this important book, and this is your book, Fatal Embrace, is a critique of exceptionalism and the insistence that a Jewish sense of being God's one chosen people is rooted in an old tribalism that is no longer viable in a pluralistic world. And he goes on to say, on the one hand, his argument invites Christian rethinking about Christian exceptionalism as well, about being the new chosen people of God and followers of the one chosen Messiah. I guess the broader question for me is, can these religions really change and leave their exceptionalism to the side? Because it seems to me, for most people in these religions, it's the superiority of knowing you're right that is one of the biggest draws of these religions. And so if you take that away, are people going to want to be a part of this? Like, will it have any success? But I agree with you that we have to take this exceptionalism and superiority away, or we're going to keep doing what we've done in Gaza, what we're doing currently in the United States. I mean, history is replete with mostly Christians. This is new for the Jewish community to be doing this type of colonialism. Do you think they can change?
Well, okay, that's a great question. First of all, this is my opportunity to talk about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but before I do, exceptionalism is the key concept here. Jesus took direct aim at that. That was his target when he stood in front of the temple, when he mixed it up with the Pharisees and the priests, when he talked to the Samaritan woman who said, why are you talking to me? You know, you're a Jew, you're exceptional, I'm just a Samaritan, I'm the other, and we worship on different mountains. And he said, woman, the time will come when we don't worship on any mountain but in the spirit. This is over. Okay, so that's what Jesus was all about. The church turned its back on that early on with Constantine, and then throughout most of the ages. And, I mean, Christianity was born in the crucible of first century Palestine as a movement, a grassroots movement of resistance to empire. And then guess what? By the third century, Christianity says, yeah, we'll be the official religion of the Roman Empire, and they're off and running, and the rest is history. Then after World War II, in a paroxysm, I love that word, of guilt and shame and horror, the Christian world looks at the ovens and says, wow, we did this. Church anti-Semitism and anti-Judaism laid the foundations for this. It finally took Hitler to do that. It's been going on for a long time before that, but this was the last, and the sort of the last straw and the last piece of horror. And that was an opportunity to answer the question of why did we do this? Who are we? And it was about Christian exceptionalism. But instead, they said, wow, we really hurt the Jews. Our biggest sin was being bad to the Jews. So why don't we, instead of hating the Jews and demonizing the Jews, love the Jews and say, actually, that initial covenant between God and Abraham is in force. God loves them best, and we love you now. And here's a gift. You can go ahead and take the land because God promised it to you anyway. And, well, Jesus saying that wasn't happening anymore, well, maybe not so much. We want you to have this. And the reason for this was that that was a way for Christians to hold on to their own exceptionalism. Give it to the Jews and then hitch a ride on it. We're guests in the house of Israel. We're the new Israel, which means we are the inheritors of that covenant, which means that, like Brueggemann says, we are special. Now, as far as I have a short answer to your question about can religion do that?
Yeah.
All right. In the last days of his life, Dietrich Bonhoeffer is sitting in prison. He's not going to make it alive out of the war. Germans are going to execute him. This is a man whose heart was broken. He grew up as a bourgeois German Lutheran in the beginning of the century, which means that he believed that Germany was the perfect state, that Lutheranism was the perfect religion, the two were one, they supported one another, and all is good in the world. And then Hitler comes along, and National Socialism comes along, and it blows that all up. And to his credit, he gets it. His heart was broken. He let his heart be broken. He let that comfortable world be shattered. And at the end of his life, from prison, writing to his friend, Eberhard Betke, he says, you know, when this is over and we try to put things back together again, I think we need to be thinking about a religionless Christianity. And Bonhoeffer scholars have been scratching their heads about this since then, thinking, what did he mean? Well, I know what he meant. The greatness of the man, like Brueggemann, the greatness of the man was that he could see what the fundamental problem was, and he was ready to attack it at its core, its religion. And this is a man who loved Jesus, like, amazingly. He loved Jesus. Jesus was the center of his life, and he was able to separate it from Christianity because he saw where that leads.
I'm going to try this mic again. I want to do, trying to see if, I think I have time for two more things, and that's all I want to do, and then we'll open up for questions. This one is new to you, but you'll be fine on this one. I want to, because this frames an issue that I think is really alive in the United States and in the Western world especially, which is, how should we view Hamas and other Palestinian militants? And this person, this is a podcast from The Guardian, and this little clip does a great job of sort of giving you two camps of how people think about it, and I think you'll recognize it.
One camp in this debate, chiefly composed of Western counterterrorism experts and U.S. and Israeli security analysts, has long seen the group as defined by its violent hostility to Israel's existence. According to this view, there was nothing surprising about the 7th of October. Instead, in the words of Matthew Levitt, a former Bush administration official and the author of a 2007 book on Hamas, it demonstrated in the most visceral and brutal way that Hamas ultimately prioritized destroying Israel and creating an Islamist Palestinian state in its place. Analysts of this school tend to point to Hamas's vast tunnel infrastructure as evidence that the group protects its own fighters while leaving Gazan civilians above the surface to fend for themselves without any system of bomb shelters. An opposing, more heterogeneous camp, comprised of academics and think tankers, many of them Palestinian, sees Hamas as a multifarious, complex political actor divided between radical and moderating tendencies. Hamas, they argue, is the product of the reality under which Palestinians live, brutal occupation and blockade, and therefore potentially responsive to changes in those conditions. The problem, according to this view, is that even when Hamas leaders have appeared to be open to moderation, Israeli policy has made it impossible for the group to pursue this line without losing its credibility among Palestinians as the last standing bastion of meaningful opposition to Israel and its occupation.
So I think that's a really helpful way of framing it. I think in the West, the first view is more common. You cannot deal with Hamas. They're a terrorist group like ISIS, right? Would be the worst, or Al-Qaeda. And they just have to be totally eliminated from the conversation. They have no role in the future of a Palestinian state or Palestinian politics. That has been, we've been trying that for at least 20 years. Gaza's been blockaded for about that long. Hamas has been treated that way, sort of. It's more complicated. For about 20 years, this is what it has gotten us, essentially. And the question is, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, like going forward, and I assume we're both in the second camp where Hamas is more complicated than that and can be a more moderate force. There were times when it tried to be, right? Please, tell them about 2006.
Well, first of all, Hamas never wanted to take over Gaza. In 2005, when Israel, quote, pulled out and gave Gaza back to the Palestinians, I mean, It's down the rabbit hole. It's not what happened. They removed their 3,000 or so settlers. They installed them and multiplied them by twice that into the West Bank, and then they made Gaza into the Warsaw Ghetto. Okay, so that's what happened. They were also going to install, with our help, their own Palestinian Vichy strongman from the PLO into Gaza.
Hamas, and the PLO is
Palestinian Liberation Organization, which used to be the bad guys. Then they joined up with us, and now they're the good guys, and Hamas became the bad guys. Someday Hamas will be maybe the good guys, but there'll be a new demon to deal with. So Hamas preemptively, because they wanted to take care of their people, not in a grab for power, went ahead and did a coup, and they took over Gaza. They never wanted to rule Gaza. They don't want to rule Gaza today. They want to join up with other Palestinian organizations to be part of the Palestinian Liberation Movement for the future. And yes, they had a military wing. They had an armed wing. You know, remember the African National Congress? Did we say they shouldn't do that? Was Nelson Mandela a terrorist? Not in hindsight. He was one of the good guys. And the apartheid government were the terrorists going into the townships, you know, and killing people. So, again, you have that kind of reversal. Hamas, in 2006, there was an election sponsored by Israel, monitored by the United States. Jimmy Carter said it was the cleanest, most fair election he had ever seen between Hamas and the PLO to take over, to rule the Palestinian Authority. Hamas won big time because they had the people's support and they saw that the PLO was hopelessly corrupt and not taking care of them. Hamas was doing all kinds of good stuff on the ground. They took good care of people. They were popular. They won big time, at which point the United States and Israel said, oops, the wrong guy won, and they either imprisoned or exiled every single Hamas official who was going to have a seat.
Or assassinated. I mean, there were assassinations.
Yes, of course. I mean, Israel loves that, targeted assassinations. So systematically, continually, every moderating impulse of Hamas to join, and they were going to recognize Israel. So fine, you can have everything inside the 1948 borders. That's cool. Huge, huge concession. They recognized Israel. And they said, no, you're the bad guys, and we'll let you do that. So is it any wonder that the militant arm took over? And then, you know, 2006, 2023, you have a prison break. I just want to share a story from Ilan Pappé. When I was here 2 years ago, it turned out that I was here like two weeks.
Ilan Pappé, the historian.
The Israeli historian who does not work in Israel anymore. He wrote The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, a book that is hugely important. He told the Israelis their true story. God bless the man. So he was giving a talk right after October 11th that had already been previously scheduled in Berkeley, I think. And he said, okay, you want to understand October 7th because everybody wanted to know, what do we make of this? And he said, you have to understand the context. And he said, here's the context. Those boys and men who broke through that prison gate and swarmed into Israel and did what they did were the grandchildren of people from those villages in that area of Israel that had been dispossessed, exiled, and driven into Gaza and made to live in a prison camp. And these were their grandchildren. The kibbutzim that they went to, where they killed people, were on the sites of those villages that had been taken and turned into kibbutzim. Full stop. Thank you.
And kibbutzim is a Jewish...
Jewish settlements, colonies. Yeah. And they built them on the borders just to establish the perimeters. Yeah. I lived in one of them for a year. I didn't know it was an atrocity site.
Yeah, one of them is called Gaza, one of the villages there. All right, believe it or not, I want to end on something positive before I open it up for questions. And this is from Peter Beinart. Peter Beinart is a Jewish, now Orthodox Jewish, and I would say he's a journalist, probably the easiest way. He's also an educator. He's really great, and he's changed a lot. I mean, this guy was a big supporter of the, if I'm not mistaken, he was a big supporter of the Iraq war as a Zionist wanting to help Israel. And now he wrote the book, and that's this section that I'm about to play for you is from the book called Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. And this is his sort of positive vision for a future.
Maybe this sounds grandiose, but I don't think our transformation as Jews is necessary only for Israel and Palestine. It's necessary for the world. Almost two generations ago, humanity witnessed a new birth of freedom. Mandela walked out of prison. Russia held its first free election. Young Germans danced atop the Berlin Wall. Democracy's third wave swept aside tyrants from the Philippines to Chile to Benin. The spirit of that era has long since died. Liberty has been receding for decades. From Putin to Modi to Xi to Trump, thugs dominate the globe, inciting tribal violence while they steal their nations blind. In its unchecked cruelty and unbearable pain, the destruction of Gaza is a symbol of our age. When South Africa's legal team, black, white, Afrikaner, Muslim, won a protege of a Jewish judge on her country's Supreme Court, charged Israel at the International Court of Justice, it seemed to me that they weren't only trying to end a genocide. They were trying to pass a torch. Imagine a legal team, not with Xhosa names like Nkugatobi and Afrikaner names like Du Plessis, but with names like Khalidi and Levi, using Palestine and Israel's liberation as an example and as an instrument to seek justice around the globe. What other place on earth could more effectively rouse humanity from its desolation and birth a new age of freedom? Speaking of Abraham's descendants, in the book of Genesis, God says, "All the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you." Perhaps this is what it means for the Jewish people to bless humanity in our time. It means liberating ourselves from supremacy so, as partners with Palestinians, we can help liberate the world.
Do you think this is possible?
Here's my problem with Beinart.
Let's hear it.
Well, first of all, yes, he's changed a lot. In 2010, he wrote a book called The Crisis of Zionism, where he talks about the good Israel and the bad Israel. The good Israel is the Israel behind the 1948 lines. The bad Israel is the, quote, occupation. If we could just deal with the occupation and cut out that bad stuff, Israel's going to be okay. I think in his heart, he still wants that, because everything he said here is wonderful, but he always centers the Jews.
I'm glad you said that. I thought the same thing. I really like it, but he did do that.
In his heart, he's a Jewish supremacist. He can't let go of that. Right. And that's the problem. When our government weaponizes anti-Semitism, it's also centering the Jews and giving us all this power, which scares the shit out of me. Don't give us this power. It's classic anti-Semitism. The Jews are an international conspiracy to rule the world. They own the banks. They own the media. They own the governments. They come in with their bags of money and own Congress. That's true. I've heard that from people on Capitol Hill, you know, speaking like behind closed doors. So I deeply distrust the fact that he is now the darling of the world because he's a Jew saying the right things. People, Christians, want to be made comfortable thinking that now the Jews are on board, so now we can take action. And what I say, and I do a lot of work with the churches, that's been my whole thing for the last 20 years. It's been my organizing strategy. You know, can the churches be roused to do what they did? tried to do with the confessing church in Nazi Germany? Can the churches be roused to stand up and do what they did in the civil rights movement, where the whole thing was hatched in the basement of black churches and then spread to the churches in general and then took over the whole society?
But that, it was a minority.
Yes, they were a minority.
Always, right? All of these cases you're giving, the Christians, the majority of Christians were not civil rights supporters.
No. And, you know, right? Today, of course, everybody, all Christians say, oh, yeah, I marched with Martin. Yeah. The black people said, that marched with Martin. They did not march with Martin. At the end of his life, he was isolated. But okay, I mean, you know, I like to say Jesus had 12, right? And look what he started. So at least in the narrative.
Probably more, I mean.
Yeah. Well,
the ladies were helping him, enough, you know, financially. Enough, he was supported by women.
enough to make the Jewish aristocracy of the time really nervous and to manipulate the Romans into executing him as a criminal. And there's a longer story there.
I hear you.
But what I say, so anyway, so when I came back in 2006, after undergoing my sort of beginning of my conversion to being anti-Zionist, after finally seeing the quote, what we called then the occupation, didn't yet know that it was, I didn't think in terms of settler colonialism, but I saw enough. And went back to my Jewish community. They didn't want to hear from me. They exiled me. They excommunicated me. You can't be a Jew and say these things. And nothing's changed. They're still dug in to that. That's a tragedy. That's a problem. The rest of, you know, rest of America needs to let the Jews deal with that problem. And what I say is, I'll take the job, but I pray for the day that, again, I'm speaking to Christian church people. Very progressive. I pray for the day when you don't need a Jew's permission to be faithful followers of Jesus. Don't, you know, let us do our thing. This is not a Jewish problem. It's a human rights problem, and it's a Christian and a church problem, because your confession says when you see something like this, you have to do something about it. And most Christians have said, yes, we know it. We know about mission. We'll do that, but not about this. Because we don't want to hurt the Jews anymore, and we think, you know, the Bible says that they should get this. So,
in their defense, it does say that the Bible.
No, of course. Right. Well, throw out the Old.
I mean pretty consistently throughout the Old Testament.
Bible, you know, and they're saying, but the fact is, the Old Testament still plays big time. And why? Because Jesus' whole thing was. Throw that out.
He's too weak.
No,
he's too
more
weak
temple.
For people.
No. I mean, it's about ethnic cleansing. It's about exceptionalism. It's about God choosing one people. Jesus said, that's over. So, but it's human nature. The church turned it back on it. When does the church stand up? Why the church finally stood up against South African apartheid? It was hugely, hugely instrumental in finally getting Reagan and Thatcher to endorse the sanctions. The World Alliance of Reformed Churches in 1982, because eight black pastors from South Africa came to that conference and said, we will not sit at the Lord's Supper with you because the church is officially segregated in South Africa. And to its credit, the Reformed Churches of the world did the Protestant equivalent of excommunicating the offending churches in South Africa, said we are in a confessional status. Nothing moves until we remove this obstacle to our being okay with Jesus. And so I say to Christians, as far as we're concerned, as far as the Jews are concerned, listen to Jesus. Pray for us. But do not wait for us, because you will wait too long. You got to put your own house in order. That's why I'm so deeply distrustful of Peter Beinart, because it makes Christians feel comfortable. Right. And he still wants the Jews, with the Palestinians, of course, holding hands nicely, to save the world.
That's right. Yes, that's it. There's a salvation thing in there. Questions? It's funny because you're saying like anti-Semitism is a problem, but also philo-Semitism is kind of a problem. Yeah, yeah. Well, we got a lot of philo-Semites in Southwest Michigan. I'll tell you that right now. Any questions? I will come to you with this mic.
Explain
philo-Semite. It's the opposite. So it's like a lover. Philo is love. A lover of Jewish people. I'm thinking of like Ray Vanderlaan, just to give an obvious name to you, right? And all of the Christian church movement around here, there's a lot of that. And it leads around here to a severe lack of criticism of the state of Israel. I mean, the company that Ray Vanderlaan uses literally says we exist to bless Israel, the travel company that he uses. That's here in Holland. So that's similar to what you're talking about, the fatal embrace, right? Yeah. Questions. You can ask anything we didn't cover that you have a question about. Feel free to ask about that. There's tons of things to cover. So if there's something we didn't get to.
I hope it works. Good. Good. This may be just too open-ended of a question, but when you brought up Dietrich Bonhoeffer, it reminded me of, I've just read a second time through Kristen Cobez Dumais' Jesus and John Wayne. There's so much in the book. And she talks about this fellow named Eric Metaxas. That's exactly what I'm going to ask. What is your opinion about the biography he wrote?
Don't get me started.
Dietrich. Oh, shoot. Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Thank
you.
You know, I have to admit that I could not finish reading the damn book.
He's a right-wing figure. I mean, he's a Trumper. He's all of these things.
Yeah, and he latched on to Bonhoeffer. Now, Bonhoeffer has been latched on in many ways by many people. The Lutherans, for example, sorry for the Lutherans in the room, so I'm generalizing, I shouldn't do that, but the Lutherans, who among Christian denominations carry the greatest burden of guilt about, I don't call it the Holocaust, it's like the Jews' own genocide. So I call it the Nazi genocide. The Lutherans carry the greatest burden of guilt because of the Lutheran Church in Germany and the fact that it ran headlong to embrace National Socialism. And you've got the bishop that they appointed, you know, up there with Goering and the others doing this. So the Lutherans have more of a problem than other Christians, and they love Bonhoeffer because they say Bonhoeffer died for the Jews. And he helps expiate our guilt. And he was, you know, and Jews talk about him as a good Gentile because he saved Jews. Bonhoeffer did not die for the Jews. Bonhoeffer died for Germany, and he joined the conspiracy to assassinate Hitler, not to save the Jews, but to save Germany and his church. And, of course, he understood that the genocide of the Jews was part of that problem. But they want to make him into a martyr. I wrote a whole paper about this. I don't know what else to say about it. Metaxas uses Bonhoeffer. He wants to. I think he's the same guy who tried, for whatever reason in the world, to establish that Bonhoeffer had a homosexual relationship with his best friend. I don't believe that. No. I mean, Bonhoeffer didn't even have a sexual relationship with his girlfriend.
I mean, well, now the other theory is starting to make a lot more sense, actually. I'm sorry. Sorry.
Well, that's a hard one to follow. So I'm interested in your perspectives on the differences between the nation state of Israel and Israel in perspective of Romans 4 as descendants of Abraham through faith. Israel as were descendants of Abraham by faith in Romans 4, as opposed to Israel, the nation state.
Yeah, well, running it into Paul, that opens up a whole interesting conversation. Because Paul, I identify strongly with Paul. He was really struggling with his identity, and who was he? Because he felt strongly that he was a Jew. And yet, he's organizing this whole movement and what he called a church, which was going to separate him from the rest of the Jewish community that he came from. So there was a parting between the Jews who said, you know what, this Jesus guy, it's not what we're after. We like the exceptionalism. We like being God's chosen, and we like suffering for that. And we'll play games. We'll play along with the Romans. And Jesus was so radical that it's no wonder that the majority of the Jews of the time said, forget about it. And we'll keep circumcision, and we'll keep the Sabbath, and we'll keep the dietary laws. And we like being separate and different. That's at the heart of our identity. And Jesus just threw that out. He said, forget about that. It was hard for people to take. Paul got it. So the nation state of Israel is a natural expression of that same separateness and exceptionalism that during all of those years of powerlessness since the Romans destroyed and sacked Jerusalem in the year 70, it just flowered and took root. It was given political power, and they're back to it. I mean, Jesus, the conversation between the Jews of the time, and Gary Birch used to be here at Calvin, talks about this. Jesus was anti-territorial. Jesus was saying, we're not special anymore, and it's for everybody. And that's what that was about. So Zionism turns its back on that, completely. Now, as far as part of Paul's thing about faith was, he was saying, "Look," and he was just speaking almost in Jesus' words. He was saying, "It's not about who you're. It's not about genealogy or carnality, as it was. It's not about that. It's about faith. It's about being on board with basic human values." That's what makes us all beloved and chosen. And join that club, and you don't have to be circumcised, and you don't have to be a descendant of Abraham, and you don't have to be white, black, or whatever. And it's what Jesus said to the woman at the well. He said, no more mountains, no more temples. It's the Spirit. And I think that's what Paul was talking about in terms of faith. And Paul was trying to build not an institution, not a new religion, but a community of, quote, those who follow Jesus. It's, I think, what Martin Luther King was talking about when he talked about the beloved community. Basically, he didn't make up that term. It was, what's the name of the philosopher that just wrote about that? He didn't make it up, but he got it. Beloved community. Everybody can join. And that's, I think, what Paul was after, and he was drawing that as a direct distinction from carnality or genealogy.
The Jews.
Tony Judt, if you know his work, and a wonderful Brit who settled here in America and wrote a famous article in 2002 called Zionism, the Anachronism. Or maybe it was 2004. Anyway, he tells a story that he was, I don't know when it was, late 20th century probably, he was at some sort of gathering in New York, and he was sitting next to the outgoing ambassador of Israel to the United States. And the guy said to him, well, I'm leaving, and my mission is accomplished. What is my mission as the ambassador from Israel, the official spokesperson of the state of Israel, is to make sure that nobody ever fails to conflate or confuse the state of Israel and the Jewish people and Zionism and Judaism. They are one and the same. That was the official diplomatic policy of the state of Israel, which is brilliant. It makes sense because nobody in this era wants to be accused of being anti-Semitic. It's like the worst name you can be called, even maybe worse than racist these days. And so it's really very simple. Zionism is not Judaism. Before 1948, most of organized Judaism, institutional Judaism, was officially anti-Zionist. We do not want to be confused. We do not want a nation state of our own. That's for the Catholics. They have the Vatican. Nobody else does that. Nobody wants an Islamic state. Supposedly, we don't want America to be called a Christian country. So why do the Jews get to have a Jewish state.
A lot of people do want America to be a Christian country.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. I said it like in quotes. It's always out there, but it's bad. So most Jews at that point, but then after World War II and after the establishment of the state, there was a train, you had to be on it. You had to take the pledge and say, Israel is to be Jewish is to be Zionist. And if you say something, and Israel is synonymous with the Jewish people. And that has had a lot of power. It goes along with that comfortable Philo-Judaism. You know, we're going to take care of Israel. Underneath it is fear and hatred of Jews. Don't give us all that power. So, I mean, if you ever accused of being anti-Semitic because you're raising questions about the state of Israel, or you use the P word and talk about the Palestinians and what the fact that their human rights have been swept away, you say, well, I heard it from a Jew, and there are many like him, who say that... to be against what the policies of a sovereign state, which is now a rogue state committing heinous human rights violations, which is, calls itself Israel, and they did not choose that name by accident, they will say, this is not the same as me as a Jew. I do not identify with any of that. Judaism used to be officially anti-Zionist. We want to be like you Protestants. We want to be part of a larger community. We want to be identified with whatever nationality we live in. We don't want to be accused of having another nationality that we're loyal to. We don't want to be accused of being a fifth column. I mean, it's supposed to be an answer to anti-Semitism. It absolutely causes anti-Semitism. It absolutely plays to the classic anti-Semitic tropes. The Jews are not good Germans. They're not good French. They're not good Americans because they owe their allegiance to another state.
I'm going to invite up Scott Nagelvoort to close this out. I just want to say one thing about Judaism real quick, which is it was a lot of work to recreate Judaism without a temple and without the land. And it happened. Like, it survived that major rupture in the early first century. That was a major accomplishment that is now kind of being thrown away. You know what I mean? Which is what you're saying. So this idea that it has to be Zionist, it has to have a land, it's not true historically. In fact, not even close.
Themselves together as nation states, in the case of Italy, hadn't even been true before that. And so the Jews were, you know, the Enlightenment, what's the word? Not the emancipation, the liberation. What was it Napoleon was trying to do? Napoleon, when he said everybody should be equal and we should not kick the Jews around anymore. And it failed. It failed terribly. The Dreyfus Affair, where this Jewish general was accused of a crime he didn't commit. This is the late 19th century, and it showed that right underneath the surface of all the stuff about how we're going to be an egalitarian society, French Revolution and all of that, underneath the surface was deep, entrenched, rampant, ugly anti-Semitism. Jews felt that. And then in Russia, under the Tsars, it was hell. It was terrible. That's why I'm here, and most of the Jews you meet in America are second generation of immigrants because they had to get out and come here, and the doors were wide open. So the emergence of Zionism has to be seen in that context of the growth of nationalism at the end of the 19th century. We'd like one of those. We'll take that. And then Britain, the British, deeply Christian Zionists and anti-Semitic, they invented Zionism long before the Jews did, said, we can use this. We can use this to for our post-World War I plans for the Middle East, as they called it. And we'll use the Zionists to establish a white European beachhead in the heart of the Middle East. So we were used. Again, it was never a good deal for us. And we went for it, and we bid it. And now we are in such deep trouble. I mean, Israel is a deeply, deeply disturbed society. It's not sustainable. It's really a tragedy. In some ways, I feel more deeply for my Jewish cousins and family and friends and all those Jews in Israel who, when, you know, their grandparents came as the original Zionist settlers, you know, who were, and they were atheistic socialists. And they were going to build a wonderful society. They did not know that they were being inducted into a racist settler colonial program. They were used, and now their grandchildren are so fucked up that you cannot imagine. Yeah, so Palestinians are being, they're being screwed, but they're not fucked up. They know who they are, and they know that their existence and their hope and their whole identity is about resistance. That's character. They know who they are. The Jews who were behind that wall that they built and who are the real prisoners of that wall, spiritually, psychologically. You know, in my former life, I was a psychologist. I specialized in post-traumatic stress disorder. We did a lot of work with Vietnam War veterans. That's how the whole diagnosis was invented. Before that, it was shell shock. Nobody understood it. Vietnam vets started to turn up with these symptoms that looked all a lot the same and very disturbed, very, very disturbed, injured, unhealthy individuals. And so some very brilliant psychiatrists and social workers started to work with that, and they discovered that what you don't diagnose them with the classic psychiatric diagnoses on a medical model. You know, let's give them pills. They're psychotic. They have anxiety disorder. They're depressed. Nobody ever asked them, what happened to you? Just like nobody was asking women who were being abused, who were turning up in mental health facilities, depressed and anxious. They were treated as being depressed. Nobody ever said to them, is anybody hurting you? Or did somebody hurt you early in your life? Nobody asks those questions. You start to ask those questions, and 80 to 90%, you find out that the answer is yes, and that the symptoms are a lot the same as the GIs who were coming back from Vietnam. And we learned that the treatment of choice is to get those people in a group to normalize for them and to make it okay and to understand that other people were feeling the same things for the right for the same reasons, and to talk about what had happened to them that had caused them to hate themselves and to feel like they couldn't trust other human beings anymore. And so they were able to look at their wounds and to start to metabolize that and to work that through and to maybe find their way, wounded, scarred, but back into life. That was the genius and the importance of that diagnosis, okay? The treatment of choice is not to take a traumatized people, put them, surround them with a fortress wall, post soldiers around that wall and say to them, that world is safe out there, trust no one, we will take care of you, right? And you see that also with demagogues. You see that with Trump and all those folks who are trying to gain power and control it. There's an enemy out there, we'll take care of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. This night was really good for me on lots of... Oh, but I'm Scott Neglevoort, Josh said it. I sit on the board of Still Processing, and tonight was good for me for several reasons. One, I've been arguing with the board that we could go 90 minutes and keep people's attention, and I stood right there and watched all of you fully engaged. So thank you for that. That will come up at the next board meeting. Second, and I hope I don't embarrass anyone here, well, I won't, I don't need to point it out, in the midst of some things Josh was showing, we had an outburst from the audience that I thought was fantastic. So I just like it when people wear their hearts on their sleeves. So thank you, sir. And third, you swore more than I did tonight, and that's always good when someone in the room swears more than I do. It was definitely okay. So I spent my lunch hour today putting notes together. You'll all be thankful that we've gone 90 minutes, and I'm not going to go through my notes. Still processing. This is the stuff. This is what we want to do. It makes a difference in my life, and I hope it makes a difference in your life. Next year, we've got lots of things planned. You heard we're going to bring Josh on as a full-time employee. That's wonderful. We're going to get close to doubling our events. It's a big year next year. I invite all of you to join me in supporting this organization. So please give that some thought. I also understand there's some books over here for sale, but mostly, Mark, thank you. Tonight was fantastic. I appreciate it.
One more thing. I just want to say one more thing. Chris Hedges was really, it was the same words that I had written in an unpublished Substack. He said, "This genocide is our genocide. This fight is our fight." That's what we're up against right now. We have to fight. And for those whose hearts bleeds for the Palestinians, I realized this the other day, the best thing we can do for the Palestinian people is to fight for our own country. It's our fight. Their fight is our fight. And Jesus talked about this a lot too, this terrific grassroots organizer. You listen, Bonhoeffer said this, you listen. The true church is a church from below. Those voices, the voices of people who suffer, that's our world. If we don't see that and believe that, we're living in a bubble. Well, guess what? The bubble, if it hasn't burst yet, it's bursting.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you to everybody. Hope to see you next month. Be well.